content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the March 23rd, 2018 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week has a smiling Kim Jong-un in the foreground, and his left hand, even coming forward towards us, is a bouquet of flowers. Things are green around him. It looks like a spring-type setting, but in the background, over his right shoulder, you see one of these big tank-type trucks that's carrying a missile on the top of it. And the title of the magazine this week says, A Trap for Trump, The Potential Pitfalls of the Upcoming Talks with Kim. I think we get that story in the controversy of the week, but the main story we'll start with is an emboldened Trump axes Tillerson. What happened? Beginning a major shakeup of his cabinet, President Trump this week ousted Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State and nominated CIA Director Mike Pompeo to succeed him. Tillerson, who feuded with the president during his 14-month tenure at Foggy Bottom and once was quoted as calling him a effing moron, learned of his dismissal when Trump tweeted that he was being replaced. While House Chief of Staff John Kelly reportedly called the former ExxonMobil CEO last Friday to warn that the president wasn't happy with him, but didn't go into specifics. Explaining his decision, Trump insisted he got along well with Tillerson, but said they weren't thinking the same on the Iran nuclear deal and other key foreign policy issues. In his farewell speech, a somber Tillerson did not thank or even mention the president by name. Pompeo, a hawk on Iran, has forged a close rapport with Trump during frequent intelligence briefings. To replace Pompeo at the CIA, Trump selected Deputy Director Gina Haspel, a controversial figure who participated in the agency's harsh interrogation program during the Bush administration. Both appointments require Senate confirmation. Trump suggested further personnel changes were likely, saying he was very close to having the cabinet he wanted. Several reports named National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster as next on the chopping block. The president was also said to be considering replacing Kelly, whom he finds too controlling, and his scandal-laden Veteran Affairs Secretary David Shulkin. What the editorial said: Tillerson deserved better than the shabby way he was fired, said the Wall Street Journal, but he had to go. His efforts to reorganize the State Department destroyed morale at Foggy Bottom and led to a stampede of staff departures. Dozens of important positions remained vacant, including key ambassadorships in South Korea, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. Tillerson's larger problem, though, was that he disagreed with Trump on almost every major policy issue. He was against scrapping the Iran deal, supported staying in the Paris Climate Agreement, and opposed moving the U.S. Embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. That was just not sustainable. Tillerson was at least a moderating influence on our ignorant president, said the Los Angeles Times. The same can't be said for Pompeo, a Trump sycophant and partisan Republican. Haspel's ascension at the CIA is no less worrying, said the New York Times. After 9/11, the veteran intelligence operative played a direct role in the spy agency's infamous extraordinary rendition programming, running a black site in Thailand where terror suspects were brutally tortured, She later ordered the destruction of videotapes of these often fruitless and shameless interrogations. What the columnist said: "For a diplomat, Tillerson wasn't very diplomatic," said Susan Glasser in Politico.com. The haughty former corporate executive feuded with fellow cabinet members, clashed with White House staff, ignored Congress, and openly disdained the press. Unwilling to hide his many disagreements with Trump, even refusing to deny he called Trump a moron, Tillerson found himself comically out of the loop. Many foreign officials treated him as irrelevant. "The timing of his firing is curious," said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. Only hours before Trump canned him, Tillerson strongly denounced Russia over the attempted nerve gas assassination of a former spy in Britain. Given the president's mysterious habit of refusing to challenge or offend Moscow, could this have been his real motive? More likely, Trump was thinking about his upcoming summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, said Mark Thiessen in The Washington Post. Tillerson undermined Trump by begging Kim for negotiations rather than pushing the hardline stance that produced the breakthrough. Ahead of his biggest diplomatic gamble, Trump wants a trusted advisor at state. "The Trump presidency is entering a new phase," said Gabriel Sherman in VanityFair.com. "Increasingly comfortable in the job, the president is feeling liberated to act on his impulses. We saw it with his unexpected announcements on trade tariffs and North Korea. Now he wants to surround himself with staff who won't restrain, resist, or undermine him. Trump, in short, is returning to campaign mode and preparing to go full Make America Great Again." Our controversy of the week: North Korea. Can Trump succeed where others have failed? President Trump's claim that he's a master dealmaker is about to face the ultimate test, said Yochi Driesen in Vox.com. Trump last week stunned the world and his own foreign policy advisors by abruptly accepting an offer to meet with dictator Kim Jong-un to negotiate the future of North Korea's nuclear weapons program. Kim has promised a missile test freeze as a show of good faith, and unless something goes wrong, the talks could happen in about 2 months. "Negotiating with Kim is certainly better than exchanging threats to incinerate each other's population," said Ryu Spaeth in NewRepublic.com. "But the odds of Trump pulling off a Nixon in China breakthrough with North Korea are infinitesimally small. Trump lacks the emotional fortitude and intellectual wiles to wrest the meaningful concessions from the canny, duplicitous Kim, who is highly unlikely to surrender the nuclear weapons he believes ensure his regime's survival. Is Trump falling into a trap that Kim has laid, like a cackling Bond villain with utter transparency? This negotiation will be like Richard Nixon going to China," said Jeffrey Lewis in foreignpolicy.com. "But if Nixon were a moron." Reportedly, Trump jumped on Kim's offer, relayed by South Korean diplomats, not realizing that North Korea had been begging for a presidential meeting since at least the Clinton administration. Trump's predecessors all rebuffed these overtures, refusing to elevate the authoritarian leader of North Korea's Orwellian regime to equal status with America's president. But Trump is evidently convinced that his own personal genius not only brought Kim to the table, but can now persuade him to give up his nuclear weapons. Kim, however, knows that when Muammar al-Qaddafi surrendered his nuclear weapons, he was invaded, toppled, and beaten to death by a mob. This meeting is occurring only because of Trump's childish need to one-up previous presidents, said William Salatin in Slate.com. He'll directly negotiate with Kim simply because no other president has done it. On North Korea, Trump has actually done far better than his predecessor, said Ed Krawiecki in TheFederalist.com. The president has made Kim very nervous by flexing U.S. military muscle with a gusto that his predecessors lacked, and by organizing the toughest ever sanctions against the Hermit Kingdom, with even China joining in. For Trump, Kim's peace overture is a huge diplomatic win. In negotiating with Kim, Trump does have one major advantage over previous presidents, said Ross Douthat in NYTimes.com. He doesn't care about promoting democracy or human rights abroad. So any promises he makes to Kim not to pursue regime change will be more believable. In exchange for a real guarantee of his survival, who knows what Kim might give up? The more worrying question is, what will Trump give up, said Thomas Wright in TheAtlantic.com. He may be so eager for a historic win that he'll agree to Kim's offer to surrender his ICBMs in return for a U.S. troop withdrawal from South Korea. That would be a disaster, exposing our ally to later invasion. Unfortunately, Trump has made it clear he thinks defending the South is a waste of U.S. dollars. Let's hope this White House knows what it's doing, said Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. If the talks fail and insults resume, a catastrophic war becomes far more likely. If a deal is struck that strengthens Kim and inspires other rogue regimes to engage in nuclear blackmail, the outcome will be nearly as bad. Either way, we will be living with the consequences of Trump's high-stakes gamble for decades to come. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for vanity after a California legislator introduced a bill that would let applicants for driver's licenses take as many photos as they want until they get one they like. The fee charged for each additional photo would fund high school driver's ed programs for teenagers. It was a good week for downsizing with the news that the military parade through Washington, D.C., that President Trump has ordered later this year, will not include any tanks. Consideration must be given to minimize damage to local infrastructure, Pentagon officials said. And it was a good week for Jane Doe, who has won her legal battle to remain anonymous after winning $560 million in New Hampshire's state lottery. Doe's lawyers successfully argued that lottery winners have historically been victimized by the unscrupulous. But it was a bad week for quiet time after three daycare workers from Illinois were charged with giving two-year-olds melatonin-laced gummies to ensure they'd take a nap. Giving a sleep-inducing hormone to kids without parental consent, police said, was just a horrible case of bad judgment. It was a bad week for Lower Michigan, which has the highest chance of being hit by China's Tiangong-1 satellite when it crashes to Earth in April. But the probability that any specific person will be struck, said experts, is far smaller than the odds of winning the Powerball jackpot. And it was a bad week for the mysteries of love after the Edinburgh Zoo suspended its panda breeding program due to the pandas' lack of interest. Zoo officials said they would stop encouraging pandas Tian Tian and Yang Guang to mate until officials consult the latest thinking on the incredibly complex and unpredictable breeding process. And before we move from here, we'll read a boring but important item. Kudlow to join White House. President Trump this week tapped CNBC personality Larry Kudlow as the next director of the National Economic Council, replacing former Goldman Sachs executive Gary Cohn as his top economic advisor. Kudlow, 70, served in the Office of Management and Budget under President Ronald Reagan before joining investment bank Bear Stearns. An outside advisor to Trump, Kudlow has publicly criticized the president's decision to impose steep tariffs on steel imports, a move that prompted Cohn's own resignation. But Trump said Kudlow has since come around to his way of thinking. Kudlow has also argued against withdrawing from the North American Free Trade Agreement, setting him up for battles with the White House protectionist camp. We're on the briefing page. This week, the history of the NRA. How a gun hobbyist club morphed into one of the most powerful political organizations in the U.S. When was the NRA founded? In 1871, by two Civil War veterans in New York, one of them a former New York Times reporter. They, along with the National Rifle Association's first president, Union General Ambrose Burnside, hoped to improve the dismal shooting abilities of the average Union soldier. Yankee troops fired 1,000 rounds for every bullet that struck a Confederate soldier, according to an official study. Their original mission focused on hunting, conservation, and marksmanship. There was no mention of protecting the Second Amendment right to bear arms. Indeed, for nearly a century, the NRA actively lobbied for gun control, co-authoring gun restrictions with the government right up until the 1970s. Historically, says UCLA law professor Adam Winkler, the leadership of the NRA was more open-minded about gun control than someone familiar with the modern NRA might imagine. What restrictions did they endorse? The NRA backed the nation's first federal gun laws after the Prohibition era, when Tommy gun-wielding gangsters warred in the streets of Chicago. The National Firearms Act of 1934 and 1938 placed heavy taxes and regulations on machine guns, sawed-off shotguns, and silencers, prohibited felons from owning weapons, and required gun owners to register with the federal government. NRA leader Carl T. Frederick not only endorsed the legislation, he went so far as to state, "I have never believed in the general practice of carrying weapons. I think it should be sharply restricted and only under licenses." How long did that position last? Right through the 1960s, when assassinations and street violence rocked the nation. When it emerged that Lee Harvey Oswald had used a rifle purchased by an NRA mail order advertisement to assassinate President John F. Kennedy in 1963, NRA Executive Vice President Franklin Orth backed the banning of mail order sales. And when members of the Black Panther Party marched on the California Capitol carrying shotguns and rifles, the NRA supported state legislation prohibiting open carry in public places. There's no reason why on the street today a citizen should be carrying loaded weapons, said then-Governor Ronald Reagan. After gunmen assassinated Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy, Congress passed the Gun Control Act of 1968. The law imposed various new restrictions, including on the shipping of guns across state lines. When did things change? By 1968, there were rumbles of rebellion against gun control within the NRA. Though the organization supported the Gun Control Act, it blocked attempts to include a national gun registry and a requirement for all gun carriers to hold a license. Then in 1971, federal agents shot and paralyzed longtime NRA member Kenyon Ballou during a gun raid at his home in Maryland. Anti-government sentiment surged within the ranks, and hardliners became increasingly impatient with the leadership's soft stance. Things came to a head on the night of May 21st, 1977, known in NRA lore as the Revolt at Cincinnati, when gun rights radicals stormed the group's annual meeting in Ohio and demanded changes to the governing structure. The old guard was ousted, and new Executive Vice President Harlan Carter, who had served time for shooting dead a Mexican teenager, spelled out the new approach. No compromise, no gun legislation. The NRA would become an organization so strong, said Carter, that no politician in America mindful of his political career would want to challenge our goals. How did it build its power? The NRA began grading politicians from A to F on gun control legislation. Those with the best report cards were given campaign money. The rest earned the wrath of the NRA's ballooning membership, which tripled following the Cincinnati revolt. Senator Bob Dole, the Republican from Kansas, complained of a litmus test every 5 minutes. The leadership adopted a new motto: the right of the people to bear arms shall not be infringed, and waded deeper into the culture wars, fueled by the spread of Waco-inspired conspiracy theories about gun-confiscating government forces in black helicopters. Each piece of gun legislation was framed as the first step toward total disarmament, driving members to the ballot box. By 2000, new NRA President Charlton Heston was challenging Democratic presidential candidate Al Gore to pry Heston's colonial-era musket from my cold, dead hands. Gore lost the election. A year later, Fortune named the NRA the most powerful lobbying group in Washington. What about recent years? Led by Executive Vice President Wayne LaPierre, the NRA continues to exert huge political influence. In 2013, when support for universal background checks rose to 91% after the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, the organization blocked congressional efforts to pass background check amendments. The activism of its 4 million members is perhaps its strongest asset. Gun rights supporters are four times as likely to have donated money and written a politician about the issue as gun control advocates, according to one study. Those members are unmoved by stories about their early leader supports for gun control. That was then, said one NRA supporter recently on Guns and Ammo's online forum. Now is now. The corporations calling the shots. The NRA used to tout its independence from gun manufacturers, branding itself as the century-old voice of average Joe hunters and sports shooters. Today, though, the organization bolsters its funds with million-dollar donations from 22 different gun makers, including Smith & Wesson and Beretta USA. The NRA received up to $52.6 million in industry donations between 2005 and 2013, according to one report, and from some gun and ammo companies, it makes $1 from every purchase. The gun manufacturer's influence is clear. Today, the NRA's answer to every mass shooting is more firearms, even in schools and churches. Today's NRA is a virtual subsidiary of the gun industry, said Josh Sugarman, executive director of the Violence Policy Center, a gun control organization. While the NRA portrays itself as protecting the freedom of individual gun owners, It's actually working to protect the freedom of the gun industry to manufacture and sell virtually any weapon or accessory. Time for a few columns. The first comes from the U.S. Immigration is not a right. Many liberals see anti-immigration sentiment as a threat to democracy itself, said James Kirchick. Activists egg on states and cities to openly defy federal immigration laws, and many leftists seem to believe that the very concept of borders is immoral, and that any enforcement of immigration law is fascist. Many activists would even eliminate any meaningful distinctions between citizens and non-citizens. As someone who is generally pro-immigration, I think the growing democratic extremism is a major mistake. An economic migrant wanting to enter the country does not have a right to do so. And even liberal democracies can limit who enters and gets to become a citizen. The truth is, many of the proposals to restrict immigration here and in Europe are actually quite popular. Liberal contempt for any restrictions has pushed many centrist voters in the U.S. and Europe into the arms of populist anti-immigration parties. That clash of extremes poses the real danger to democracy. As long as liberals refuse to make any concessions whatsoever on immigration and portray every move to strengthen borders or discourage further migratory waves as one more step in the march toward fascism, the only people who benefit will be the fascists. This comes from Bosnia-Herzegovina, a nation on the verge of collapse. Bosnia Muslim politicians are at one another's throats, and that's a threat to peace in Bosnia-Herzegovina, said Nadezhda Letic. This country was torn apart in the 1992-95 Bosnian War, and stability here depends on a balance of ethnic Muslim, Croatian, and Serbian elements in the government. If any one leg weakens, the stool will topple. The Party of Democratic Action, SDA, has been the main party of Bosnian Muslims since its founding in 1990 by Alija Izetbegovic, Bosnia's wartime president. But the current leader, Izetbegovic's son Bakir, has alienated party members. At least three top SDA lawmakers have quit the party in recent weeks, and each wants to form his own New Bosnian Muslim Party. Frustrated by this disloyal secessionism, Bakir reacted in the worst possible way, by using the word war to describe the political infighting. Given that more than 100,000 people, the vast majority of the Muslims, were slaughtered in the Bosnian War, it's beyond irresponsible for Bakir to say, as he did recently, that he would sacrifice peace for the integrity of the state. Meanwhile, the other significant party of Bosnian Muslims, the Social Democrats, is also imploding in factional struggle. This utter breakdown of political representation comes as war veterans protest in the streets for higher benefits. Political collapse is dangerous in any country. Here, it can be fatal. And this is an international How They See Us column titled, Can Trump Talk Sense into Kim? An astonishing and unprecedented diplomatic summit could finally bring peace to the Korean Peninsula, said the Hankore from South Korea in an editorial. U.S. President Donald Trump last week abruptly accepted an invitation from North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un to hold direct talks by May. Nothing less than the scrapping of North Korea's nuclear weapons program will be on the table at that meeting, according to the South Korean envoys who delivered the invitation to the White House. The speed of the breakthrough has surprised everyone. Talks in the past, six-party affairs comprising the two Koreas, the U.S., China, Japan, and Russia, involved months of tedious planning, and some nations may feel they are being frozen out by Kim and Trump. But South Korea won't waste this opportunity. It is already scrambling diplomatic teams to Beijing, Tokyo, and Russia, knowing that the support and guarantees of those countries will be essential for the denuclearization measures. The Trump administration needs more diplomatic boots on the ground if these talks are to succeed, said Yomiuri Shimbun, Japan. The post of U.S. Ambassador to South Korea and Special Representative for North Korea Policy remain unfilled. Without a skilled U.S. negotiating team with expert insight into what Kim is thinking, the North Koreans could easily outmaneuver Trump. And even if Kim agrees to denuclearize, his word alone should not result in concessions from the U.S. North Korea must also agree to let the International Atomic Energy Agency inspect its nuclear facilities and verify the disposal of nuclear materials. U.S.-North Korea summits are nothing but starting points for a long and steep road toward achieving denuclearization. This is just another of Kim's ploys, said Yang Sang-hoon in Chosum Ilbo from South Korea. International sanctions are starting to produce real pain for North Korean officials who support their comfortable lifestyles by skimming money from trade with China. But foreign currency income from exports is expected to drop by up to 90% this year. Kim's goal is to shield himself from the impending maelstrom that will hit if the North Korean elite rebel against him. He has no intention of giving up his nukes. He simply wants sanctions relief so that he can survive the next 2 years, enough time to build more than 100 warheads. Once his nuclear arsenal reaches that level, the crisis will reach a whole new dimension. That's why sanctions relief must come only after Pyongyang has shown it is serious, said the Jung-ang Ilbo from South Korea. North Korea's official state newspaper, the Rodong Sinmun, has been railing about U.S. sanctions and hasn't even mentioned the possible Trump-Kim summit. Such a hostile environment doesn't bode well for talks, and most experts believe there's only a 50% chance they'll take place. If they do, we must follow the lead of South Korean President Moon Jae-in, whose policy of outreach led to this opportunity. Negotiations, he says, must be approached as carefully as handling glass. We have an interesting topic in our last word feature this week. I haven't had a chance to read it, so we'll enjoy it together. It is titled, Why We Relive Embarrassing Moments. Excuse me, Why We Relive Embarrassing Memories. Why is it that little humiliations from our past can still make us wince years after they've happened? Asks writer Melissa Dahl. It turns out that the stronger feeling is, the stronger the memory. The other day I was putting away laundry, my least favorite chore. My mind was wandering this way and that when, out of nowhere, a memory pulled me back to the summer of 2007. Suddenly, I'm 22 again. I was an intern in the health section at MSNBC.com, and in retrospect, I suspect I was terrifically underqualified for the role. All day I would nod along in meetings while the rest of the editors discussed things like hormone replacement therapy or hospital-acquired infections. And then, back at my desk, I would conduct quiet, frantic Google searches to figure out what on earth they'd been talking about. There were so many things to worry about. Lately, though, I'd been worrying about my clothes. The newspapers where I'd interned throughout college were very come-as-you-are, but people dressed better here, or at least my boss sure did. Sometimes, I noticed, if I showed up late but was wearing something nice, she would tacitly dismiss my tardiness. I started copying my roommate, who at 25 seemed infinitely wiser than me, and who on work days favored mid-length jersey skirts and dark, office-approved neutrals. But in this memory, the skirt betrays me. I leave the restroom, preoccupied by all of the obscure medical terms I need to look up later, and walk toward the newsroom. And then I hear a shriek of laughter to my right, coming from down the hall. I look toward the sound and see three people staring back, one of whom is literally pointing and laughing at me. I look down and, oh my God. My skirt is tucked into the back of my tights. In my apartment 10 years later, I know I'm far away in space and time from this moment, and yet it still makes me wince. I even shake my head back and forth a few times, as if I could use physical force to remove from my brain the image of the office hallway, the laughing coworker, the traitorous skirt. How embarrassing, I whisper out loud, to no one. This reaction, the way I will often respond to physically to an embarrassing memory, has always seemed like an odd personal quirk of mine. But so many people I interviewed for my new book, Cringeworthy, confessed to reacting in the same way. You're just sitting there and your brain decides to throw it in your face for no reason, one of my interviewees told me. For me, if I'm alone, I just start shouting, no, 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 no. I came across a name for these memories that I quite like, cringe attacks. They're the little humiliations from your past that come back unbidden, sometimes years after they first occurred. I recently spoke with James Dankert, a psychologist at the University of Waterloo, about this. You really relive past embarrassments, he said. This is less true of the emotion he studies, boredom. I can remember feeling bored in high school, for example, but the feeling doesn't come back with the memory. Not so with embarrassment. When you think about it again, Dankert said, you get embarrassed all over again. Recently, I had coffee with an acquaintance who told me that a couple of weeks earlier, she'd been innocently standing in front of her bathroom mirror when she flashed back to Halloween 2015. I did ecstasy and made out with two guys on the same improv team, even though she really liked another person at the party, she told me. For her, this was enough to cause a cringe attack so strong that she yelled at her reflection, oh my God, why did you do that? It happens to so many of us, but why? These memories may be embarrassing, but they're not necessarily traumatic. So what's causing them to rush back at seemingly random times? And is there any way to prevent them, or at least make them hurt a little less? I didn't get the answer I was expecting, but what I found instead was so much more interesting and genuinely useful for anyone who regularly feels under attack by embarrassing memories. The first step is somewhat obvious. Learn how to be nicer to yourself. The second is less so. Learn how to forget yourself. I have asked Nima Visa a simple question. I want him to tell me about an embarrassing memory from his past. He's had time to think about it, too, because I asked the same question in the email I sent several days ago to schedule the chat we're having now. and yet he can't answer me. Viesa is one of just 60 or so people in the world who is thought to have a highly superior autobiographical memory, or HSAM, a condition discovered in 2006 by scientists at the University of California at Irvine. He remembers nearly every day of his life in vivid detail. I, in contrast, could not confidently tell you what I did last week. Mine is only an average memory, and yet I often feel haunted by cringeworthy jolts backward in time. The more I thought about it, the more I was dying to know. What would it be like to remember your embarrassing moments when you remember everything that's ever happened to you? Earlier, I spoke with Joey DeGrandis, who also has HSAM. We had a great talk about memories and our relationships to our past selves, but he, too, struggled with my question about embarrassing memories. He and Vesey used different analogies for their memories. Vesey seems to think of his as highly organized file cabinets, while DeGrandis thinks of his past selves as being perpetually connected to his present by thousands of invisible threads. But neither of them seem to be able to use their superpower to summon an awkward moment from their past. "Isn't this your whole thing?" I shouted inwardly, while outwardly keeping quiet as they consulted their memory threads and file cabinets. I was baffled. How could it be possible that I can't stop remembering embarrassing episodes from my past when these two guys, who supposedly remember everything they've ever said or done, struggle to think of even one? To understand this, let's return for a moment to those of us with ordinary memories. Research in neuroscience might categorize the cringe attack as an example of persistence, which means pretty much what it sounds like. It's a memory that persists over time and is often involuntary and recurring. Persistence is often associated with traumatic experiences, but as the neuroscientist Dean Burnett has explained, these memories don't always come from some dramatic life event. You might be wandering along the road on your way to somewhere, he writes in his book, Your Brain is an Idiot, casually thinking about nothing in particular, and your brain suddenly says, "Remember when you asked that girl out at the school party and she laughed in your face in front of everyone and you ran away but collided with a table and landed in the cakes?" Suddenly you're racked with shame and embarrassment, thanks to a 20-year-old memory, apropos of nothing. But why do these memories so often seem to come back out of nowhere? Burnett, in his book, describes the brain not as a supercomputer that should be revered, but as a dotty, irrational thing. Imagine, he says, a computer that kept opening your more personal and embarrassing files, like the ones containing all of your erotic Care Bears fan fiction, without being asked, and at random times. To Burnett, that's not a bad metaphor for your brain. But Leah Kovslevshvili, a psychology researcher at the University of Hertfordshire, believes that memory is more orderly than that. Kovslevshvili has made a name for herself by studying what she calls mind pops, those thoughts that seem to come to you out of the clear blue sky. Early on in her research on mind pops, she wrote down every single one that happened to her over the course of 9 months, during which she experienced some 400 of these cognitive mysteries. She found some commonalities. 90% of the time, they happened when she was alone. And 80% of the time, they happened while she was doing some kind of mindless routine, like chores or personal grooming. She's replicated those results by studying people who kept diaries of their random memories. Always, people reported being engaged in an undemanding activity, just being in a relaxed state of mind, she tells me, which sounds about right. I was dragged back to 2007 while putting away laundry, and my friend flashed to a 2015 Halloween party in the middle of her morning routine. There may be a simple explanation for the neurological mechanism behind cringe attacks. Your emotions dictate what your brain decides to hang on to. The stronger the feeling, the stronger the memory. James McGaw, a neurobiologist at UC Irvine, takes me through a simplified version of the neurobiological process at work here. Something excites your brain, which triggers the release of adrenaline, which in turn releases another substance called noradrenaline, a neurotransmitter that then perks up the amygdala. That's a region of the brain which gets excited by emotional arousal, he said. The amygdala then communicates with almost every other region of the brain, and it says, in effect, something important happened. Make a strong memory. This happens in moments of embarrassment or humiliation, but it's not limited to these emotions. And it's not, as I initially assumed, limited to negative emotions either. If someone told you that you'd just won the lottery, you'd remember that moment forever. Perhaps you can still vividly recall the moment your partner told you for the first time that they loved you. And here's a practical application of which you might want to take note. This link to strong emotions may be the key to combating a cringe attack. According to one recent finding in neuroscience, it helps to try to call another non-emotional detail about a highly emotional memory. Can you remember what you were wearing? Who else was there? What did it sound like? What did it smell like? In a 2015 study, scientists found that when people took a few moments to mentally flesh out the details of a memory that caused them pain, it helped to dull the sting. Once you immerse yourself in other details, Florin Dokos, one of the researchers, explained, your mind will wander to something else entirely, and you won't be focused on the negative emotions as much. This brings us back around to Vassay, de Grandis, and others with HSAM. McGaw was part of the team of scientists who first discovered this remarkable memory ability, and he explained to me his theory about why the two HSAMers I talked to had such a hard time recalling an embarrassing episode from their past. One reason their memories may work the way they do is that everything is registered at the same emotional level. It's why the mundanities of their day-to-day lives are so readily recalled. But if everything is emotional, then nothing in particular is. It isn't that de Grandis and Vassay can't remember embarrassing moments. It's just that those moments don't stand out more vividly than any of their other memories. My own memory will never work the same as Vassay's, but as he and I talked, I realized that I could borrow from his perspective on his past. To be disciplined against embarrassment with HSAM, you kind of have to accept yourself, he said, which is a fundamental thing about embarrassment in general. The people you find who are least sensitive to embarrassment are either total jerks or else they're very self-accepting. Pair that with a reminder that you're not the only person on earth to have done something embarrassing. When we arrive at this kind of self-awareness, then when we fail, it's not poor me, it's, well, everyone fails, said Kristen Neff, a University of Texas at Austin psychologist. Everyone struggles. This is what it means to be human. It helps to see yourself. It also helps you to see beyond yourself. This was adapted from Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness by Melissa Dahl, that's D-A-H-L, published by Portfolio, an imprint of Penguin Publishing Group. Thank you. on the health and science page, we have life on one of Saturn's moons. Hardy microbes like those found on Earth may also thrive in the oceans of Saturn's sixth largest moon, Enceladus. Researchers in Austria have concluded, after 17 years collecting data on Saturn and its moons, NASA's Cassini spacecraft has shown that Enceladus has an ocean beneath its ice-covered surface and gas geysers near its southern pole. Cassini detected within these geysers life-supporting elements and compounds such as carbon dioxide, nitrogen, methane, and hydrogen, a cocktail of gases that would suggest the presence of hydrogen-consuming, methane-releasing microbes. To investigate this possibility, University of Vienna researchers simulated as best they could the conditions in Enceladus' surface ocean, then examined whether three simple microbes could grow there. To their surprise, a bacteria-like microorganism that thrives without oxygen near deep hydrothermal vents on Earth was able to tolerate the Enceladus-like environment, even when the researchers harshened conditions by adjusting the temperature and pH levels. These findings don't confirm the existence of an alien extremophiles, reports TheAtlantic.com, but they do suggest that Enceladus is a good place to look for them, especially since its ocean is believed to have hydrothermal vents. Cassini scientist Hunter Waite says another flyby of the icy moon with better instruments could confirm the team's conclusion. By sending for the distinct chemical signatures of methane-releasing microbes, someday a robotic space submarine may conduct direct explorations. And the power of touch. The simple act of holding hands with a loving partner can significantly reduce physical pain, a new study suggests. Researchers asked 22 heterosexual couples who had been together for at least a year to undergo brain scans as they participated in different scenarios. The women either sat holding hands with their partners, sat nearby but did not touch them, or were in a different room. The scenarios were then repeated, but this time with the women were subjected to mild pain. Overall, the women found that holding hands reduced the intensity of their pain by an average of 34%. The brain scans showed that when the couples held hands, their brain waves became synchronized, and that this coupling effect was even greater when the women were in pain. The researchers speculate that supportive touch could help people feel understood, which may trigger pain-reducing reward systems in the brain. We have developed a lot of ways to communicate in the modern world, and we have fewer physical interactions, lead author Pavel Goldstein from the University of Colorado Boulder tells ScienceDaily.com. This research illustrates the power and importance of human touch. And finishing out, as usual, on the Talking Points page, we have Down syndrome, the abortion question. Down syndrome is now front and center in the national debate over abortion, said Ariana Yujang Cha in WashingtonPost.com. Appalled by the 67% termination rate among women whose fetus has Down syndrome, pro-life activists have passed or introduced legislation to ban abortion for solely that reason in five states: Utah, North Dakota, Ohio, Indiana, and Louisiana. The issue has become more fraught because of a new non-invasive blood test on a pregnant woman that can detect the fetal chromosomal abnormality that causes the developmental disorder, making it easier to detect. It is simply intolerable that so many joyous lives are being snuffed out, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. People with Down syndrome are often unusually happy, and their families rarely regret having them. Yet across the Western world, abortion rates for Down's babies are climbing toward 100%. Iceland last year bragged it was on the verge of eradicating Down syndrome. In reality, Iceland is not eliminating Down syndrome. It is eliminating people with Down syndrome. I have two children, said Ruth Marcus, also in the Washington Post, and I can say without hesitation that I would have terminated either of those pregnancies had prenatal screening revealed Down syndrome. The majority of children with Down syndrome have significant cognitive impairment and a limited capacity for independent living and financial security, with a lifelong dependency on parents and other caregivers. Having a Down syndrome child is life-altering for the entire family. I respect those who make the choice to have children with this disability, but doing so is an intensely personal decision, and it's best left to the mothers, not to government officials who believe they know best. Marcus' feelings about Down babies did not arise in a vacuum, said Wesley Smith in NationalReview.com. The belief they should be aborted arises from societal pressures, genetic counselors, and a disdain in our culture for limitations. As prenatal genetic testing becomes increasingly sophisticated, we have climbed onto a slippery slope. Babies that are the wrong sex are already being aborted, and parents may soon have the option to eliminate autistic babies or those with poor eyesight or a genetic predisposition toward cancer or obesity. In this new eugenics, parents will have a right not only to have a baby, but also the baby we want. Beware where this leads. And we'll have to leave it with that. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you have enjoyed it, and be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.